You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Milwaukee woman couldn't find a community chess group in her area, so she held her own chess gathering, and to her surprise, more than 50 people showed up. We'll talk with her about her new outdoor chess club. Now, the family of George Floyd met with President Biden and some members of Congress in Washington, D.C. yesterday, 1 year after Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. President Biden had called on Congress to have the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act passed by this week. That won't happen, but the bill passed the House in March, and lawmakers negotiating in the Senate say they're optimistic they'll be able to pass it on a bipartisan basis. Currently, the legislation would make changes to qualified immunity, ban chokeholds and no-knock warrants for federal officers, and create grants for community safety groups. Qualified immunity looks like one of the most likely sticking points for a bipartisan agreement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress make some of these changes and pass this bill? Are there changes to policing you want to see maybe in your local department? If you work in law enforcement, how are you looking at this? And what questions do you have about what this federal bill would or would not do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Monica C. Bell is an associate professor of sociology at Yale University and an associate professor of law at Yale Law School. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into some of the particulars, big picture, are these big sweeping changes? Is this tinkering around the edges? What do you make of the package as it stands as a whole?
Well, you know, I suppose it depends on your perspective. So, you know, given the landscape that, you know, movement activists have been operating on, especially for the past year, you know, talking about defund the police, abolition, things like that, this bill doesn't do any of that, right? So this bill is far more incremental, is certainly kind of within the bounds of kind of traditional sorts of police reforms. And by that measure, it is not sweeping. But I think by a measure of, you know, where we are now and assuming that we're not going to abolish the police today, it actually offers a number of really significant changes in terms of data collection, in terms of how the federal government is interacting with state and local authorities, you know, a whole host of changes. I'd be happy to talk in more detail about any of them.
Yeah, what stands out to you as the biggest change when it comes to that relationship between the federal government and state and local police agencies? And we have lots of them, right? Thousands of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, traditionally, there's, you know, this kind of basic idea of federalism, which is to say, and police are really locally controlled. I mean, we have 18,000 plus police departments in our nation, and states really have what we call police power, or authority over the health, safety, and welfare of people. And so traditionally, we tend to think of policing as falling under state and local governmental aegis and not really being the business of the federal government. But of course, as in a lot of areas of health and safety and welfare, the federal government has played a substantial role in policing for a long time, whether that's funding community policing initiatives, you know, starting in the 1990s or so. You know, there are all kinds of ways. And so what this bill does is essentially expand the federal government's authority to incentivize state and local policing agencies to change their policies. So, for example, you know, there are some kind of training requirements that that are going to be pushed in the bill. And the way that actually happens is through funding mechanisms for state and local governments, and not so much through kind of like the harsh hand of the government, and the harsh hand kind of ordering people or ordering state and local governments to initiate trainings. That might be a little too technical, but that's kind of, you know, it's both traditional, but it is expanded beyond our traditional conception of the relationship between policing and the federal government.
Well, that's a really interesting point, though, and it also applies to a ban on chokeholds. There's a ban, right, as I understand, in this legislation that would apply directly to federal police officers, but then for state and local police officers, it's not banning it. But again, it's saying, Yeah, if you want our federal funding, and everybody does, you also need to ban a chokehold. Can you talk about that part of the legislation?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So, the chokehold ban operates through this funding mechanism, which is the way, frankly, almost every piece of federal legislation that operates in these areas of health, safety, and welfare, how they kind of are lived out for state and local governments. The federal government doesn't have the power to outright ban chokeholds, and their constitutional limitations. We talk about, the spending power in terms of what Congress is allowed to do with spending money. So, but it's important to understand that the mere fact that the legislation cannot ban chokeholds among all state and local police agencies doesn't mean there's nothing happening here. And that's because state and local police agencies really rely on federal dollars to kind of carry out their work. And this is true throughout the nation. State and local agencies tend to be cash strapped. And so federal dollars are really important to those agencies.
Talking to Monica C. Bell, Associate Professor of Law at Yale Law School, also Associate Professor of Sociology, looking at negotiations in Congress over a federal bill on policing. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to turn to qualified immunity. I mentioned it a few moments ago, the idea, a legal idea, in effect, that makes it very difficult to have a civil lawsuit against police officers for things they do in the line of work. This has been one of the biggest sticking points, I think, in negotiations. A Republican Senator Tim Scott says, okay, maybe we leave that for officers, but open up departments to civil action. What are your thoughts on qualified immunity and how it affects policing?
Yeah, so the qualified immunity debate has been quite fascinating to me because here's the thing. It is really rare for people who experience police misconduct to sue them for civil damages. However, when it does happen, as you're alluding to, this court-created doctrine of qualified immunity, which has as this background kind of incentive structure that we don't want people to we don't want government officials to kind of not carry out their duties because they're worried about being subject to a lawsuit later. But of course, that kind of idea, which sounds good in theory, is completely out of hand for police. It is impossible, basically, to get damages when police really do violate people's rights. And so the conversation around qualified immunity has the goal of just making it more possible for individuals whose rights have been violated to get some type of compensation for those violations. And then, of course, more broadly, to disincentivize police officers from behaving with brutality because they would actually be held liable, which almost never happens, that actually have some kind of accountability. Now, the political, so that sounds like sort of straightforward, and a lot of Americans support eliminating qualified immunity when you talk about it like that. But here's the problem. Many police unions and police advocates have painted qualified immunity as if it is the only thing that protects police officers. And so that giving it up or kind of getting rid of qualified immunity is seen as some sort of anti-police action, which is not the way it should be seen at all. Police have so many protections, including the fact that even in a case that where there was no qualified immunity, litigants who are complaining would still be, still have to, prove their case. They would still have to convince people that they should get some type of damages, and they would also have to prove that they should get a significant amount of damages. And so, I think one of the things that's so interesting to me about qualified immunity is that it does not, in my opinion, have the transformative potential with which you would think it would, based on how much of a political sticking point it has been. But I think that really comes down to this this really sad situation we're in, where any type of reform is painted by opposition as anti-police, as opposed to just wanting to make the police more just, more better, more accountable.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Beaver Dam. David, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a unique situation or outlook on this because I have a very close friend of mine that's a retired chief of police, and I had an uncle that was a Michigan State Trooper, retired now. He's passed away, but I mean, but anyway, to start with, policing is very complicated. You're dealing with a lot of, I think we have a huge problem in this country with Monday morning quarterbacking, and people don't understand what policing is all about. And you get in a situation, if you take away qualified immunity or any protection for the police for a split second decision they make, and their tails are hanging out in the breeze, trust me on this, you're not going to get anyone to step up to be in law enforcement. No one. Who would do that if you could lose your house and end up in jail for what at the time you thought was the right decision, but then gets twisted by lawyers, it ends up on the news? And all the conversations I have with my uncle, he said, certainly there are people that probably went to prison and were innocent. He said, but there's also a whole lot of them that are very good liars.
David, thanks for the call. Monica, that idea, and I think probably a lot of police officers genuinely feel this, that they would be at risk without qualified immunity of, as David said, you know, losing their house in a lawsuit after a split second decision. What would you say to an officer who's thinking along those lines?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that is a serious concern among a lot of officers. But, you know, so there are lots of jobs that are complicated and that have performance standards attached to them, in which people can be held liable if they engage in some sort of malpractice. So I'm thinking about doctors, for example. Policing is serious work, and it needs serious accountability standards. And of course, there's this problem of quote unquote Monday morning quarterbacking. We have to remember that police are officers of the public. And if there is a disconnection between what people think is justified and what police officers tend to think is justified, that doesn't mean that there should be no questions asked. Because the situation right now is that there are so few questions that are even allowed to be asked. A police officer can say, oh, well, you know, I felt that my life was at risk. And without really asking any questions about that, the whole conversation ends. And also, I think it's important to note as a historical point that, you know, we've had a long police professionalization movement in which police have gained deference by, you know, by judges, by courts, et cetera, to their expertise, their special knowledge, or special ability to make those types of split decisions that the caller was talking about. And so if one is going to have that type of power, one also has to have a corresponding responsibility to have those actions reviewed by the public. That's just the cost of gaining that type of power. So that's another kind of a thing I would say.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Monica Bell, Associate Professor of Law and Sociology at Yale University, looking at the issue of police reform at the national level as Congress negotiates the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these potential changes? What do you think about things like ending qualified immunity, banning the use of chokeholds by police, more data collection over police use of force incidents? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Monica Bell, Associate Professor of Law and of Sociology at Yale University, looking at federal police reform and where it stands a year after the murder of George Floyd. The U.S. Senate currently negotiating on a police reform bill named after Floyd. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We got a comment from Brandy on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, I'd like to see us stop counting on police for everything. If someone's calling 911 and it's possibly a mental health situation, mental health officers should be responding with officers as a backup. And Monica, I think there are some things in the bill, not directly doing that, but looking at alternatives to policing for situations so that we don't have to count on police officers being, among their other job duties, mental health experts along the way. Can you talk about that issue?
Absolutely. I completely agree with that comment. You know, we really do have to, and the thing is, you know, I'm thinking about the previous caller. You know, police officers complain all the time about being asked to do types of tasks that are outside of their areas of expertise. And so part of what the bill would do would allow funding of these types of initiatives. And we've seen some energy go into this at the state and local level, you know, since in the year since George Floyd was murdered. So we've seen programs like Eugene, Oregon's CAHOOTS program become models of having alternative sorts of responders. And so I absolutely agree that we need to proliferate those and also collect a lot of data on how well they work, develop best practices that can be used across the nation. And to the extent that the Floyd Act would help along some of those efforts, is something that there should be bipartisan support around. So having alternative responders doesn't have to mean that one is fundamentally anti-police, but it could mean that we're expanding out the types of services we have available for people in mental health crisis or for safety checks or for all of the types of work that oftentimes police officers say they don't want to do.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ruth is with us in Altoona. Ruth, hi.
Yeah, hi. You know, we used to fund human services to do this kind of crisis intervention work much better than we do now. And we had people to go on site so that the police didn't have to take on the roles they are not meant to take on. And so it was only with all these cuts, that legislators wanted to do, particularly Republicans wanted to do, to save taxes, put the burden on the police department to manage things they are not meant to manage. And so we have a history here where it used to be different.
Ruth, thanks for the call. Monica, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that is exactly right. The caller is right. You know, and it, of course, it's been different across different localities. But this basic idea, you know, especially in the 1980s or so, there was a big push toward austerity around welfare services and human services. And of course, you know, people have talked about deinstitutionalization of mental health and all of these. But the politics work out that the last thing that gets cut by a city's government are police services, and there are reasons for that that make sense. But the problem is that the kind of human needs that have been defunded are still remain. And so I think this is actually a place, if we had some of the kind of toxic pro-police versus anti-police politics going on, we could find some points of convergence, actually, especially between line officers who have to deal with these problems.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to John with us in Park Falls. John, hi.
Hello, thanks for having me.
What'd you want to bring up, John?
My concern is the police. The police have become more.
John, you're cutting in and out. I've got a note from our producer that John's worried about the militarization of police. Says he doesn't like what he sees with that. Sorry, we lost you there, John. Is that something, Monica, where you know, police end up with actually military surplus equipment, that kind of things that we've seen in counter-protest operations? Is that something that's getting focused on in the federal bill?
It actually is. There are some provisions that would kind of halt to some degree the capacity of local police departments to get that type of military leftover equipment. And it's really important. But I think this conversation about military-grade weapons obscures the bigger point, which is a kind of militaristic mentality that can happen in policing. So part of the warrant, you know, for policing in a more modern era, I should say, is not the like friendly neighborhood police officer who helps people solve their problems, but is instead what some people have talked about as like a warrior mentality. And the military weapons are only one piece of that mentality, that aspect of police culture that is going to be extremely difficult to root out.
Thanks for that call. Sorry we lost you there. Monica, in our last minute or so, what is not in this federal bill that you think could use a change?
Yeah. So there's a lot in the bill that's not present. And I think there are a few big pieces. So first, you know, even though there are ways that community or that kind of like local initiatives could be funded, there isn't a corresponding reorientation of policing, any effort to shrink really overgrown police departments. There is really very little that is core to the Black Lives Matter movement, to what some activists are talking about in the defund movement. And regardless of whether people like that language or not, the basic impulse is one about investing in communities and shoring up not just alternative safety responses, but instead new ways of thinking about how to build public safety. So that means education, that means housing, that means a whole panoply of changes that really the bill doesn't put in, that doesn't kind of engage in that movement-oriented conversation. And that, I think, is sad. But it does do a whole lot that could lay groundwork over a long term toward getting there.
Monica, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me. Have a great evening.
Monica C. Bell is an associate professor of law at Yale Law School, also a professor of sociology at Yale. She joins us to talk about the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act and what's happened with police reform in the year since Floyd's death. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a closer look at a shadowy part of the web that makes money by publishing unverified accusations against people and by forcing them to pay if they want those accusations removed. Now, some hobbies and passions just get better with a group to do them with. After a Milwaukee resident went looking for a community chess club and couldn't find one, she decided to host her own chess event after inquiring in a neighborhood Facebook group. Now it's turned into a club. Olga Thomas is a Milwaukee photographer and the founder of the Bayview Knights Chess Club. Olga, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us, first of all, just about your love of the game of chess? Where did that start?
Well, as a little girl, I used to play chess with my father. And, you know, the times that I spent with him bonding over chess, learning from him, you know, feeling loved and validated, it's very meaningful to me. So chess has, I feel very nostalgic about it.
And also, I mean, chess, I know people teach it as a great way to think and to plan and think about consequences. What do we get out of chess when we play? What are the benefits for us?
Oh, gosh, I can't brag enough about the benefits of chess. I mean, it improves focus, it develops creativity, teaches you strategy, and it just teaches you that there are consequences for your actions. So these are all great life lessons, you know, things that we can apply into our everyday life.
Okay, here we are. We're coming out of the pandemic. What set you on a path trying to find a chess club in your area?
So we were looking for a local chess club, and because of the pandemic, it was difficult to find anything available. So I simply asked a question in one of the Facebook local groups and ask who wants to play chess with me and my son. And the response was overwhelming. I had probably hundreds of messages coming in from different people. And we quickly realized that that it should be an event. It was more than I could manage, you know, as scheduling different families. So we started holding events in our front yard.
Now tell us, yeah, how did you set up, how did you get ready for your first event, not knowing how many people were going to show up to play chess?
Well, I kind of got the sense that people are interested in participating in this kind of event. So as soon as we made the decision that we want to have our own chess club, within a week we bought tables, we bought chairs, we had the logo made, we had a Facebook page, and our first event scheduled. We are doers.
And you, I guess you had 50 people show
up. We don't just dream about
things. You had 50 people show up, I understand. Did you have 25 chess sets around, or did people have to bring their own?
I asked people to bring their own, but we had people coming in and out. So we didn't have 50 people at one okay. time. People coming in and out, and rotating, playing games with different neighbors and friends. It was fun.
Now, this is a special time because we haven't been able to get together like we usually could. Chess groups, you couldn't really meet inside. What was the mood? What was the attitude for the people who showed up and enjoyed a game of chess or two?
A lot of excitement. I feel that being an outdoor event, it made people feel safe and comfortable to start interacting again with each other. So it was really neat to see the excitement. And what was neat for me was to see like a 10-year-old playing with a 60-year-old, mm-hmm. Two people that would not normally interact in the everyday life. They bonded over chess, and it just sparked a conversation between these two. It's just a singular case that I'm talking about, but it's just beautiful to see people from different backgrounds, different ethnicities coming together and doing something together, playing a game together.
And Olga, As we wrap up, you said you're a doer. You don't just think about stuff. So if somebody's out there listening, thinking, I'd love to start something in my community, whether it's chess or whatever kind of get-together hobby, what would you say to them to get them to go from thinking to doing?
Well, you need a plan. So we came up with a plan pretty quickly. So you need a plan, and then you just need to, check box. Okay, how can I accomplish this? Step by step, you can make things happen.
Olga, thank you so much for sharing this with us, and good luck with the chess club.
Thank you so much, Rob. Thank you for having me.
That's Olga Thomas, Milwaukee photographer, founder of the Bayview Knights Chess Club. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about getting back to the garden.
As the coronavirus pandemic has left more people stuck inside, a yearning to get back to nature has flourished. This is something writer Yialor of Eau Claire has been paying attention to over the last year. She tells us how she found solace in her family's garden and at the farmer's market, closely watching the fruits and vegetables.
About a month into the pandemic, in early spring, after what we hoped was the last frost, my mother and I bundled up to make our first trip out to the garden, where she divided the land and decided which crop would grow best where. After we finished planting the early spring vegetables, my mother said it was time to hoe or call the crops. Mei di mei thao o, mei thao mei kao, thuo, nei chi thuo nei lao chi ying dao. Little cucumbers, little squash, little beans, little potatoes. Grow, for if you don't, you won't beat the weeds. So they grew, and indeed beat the weeds. Most days while out in the field, with my feet in the dirt and fingers tangled in the vines, I often forgot that the rest of the Chippewa Valley had paused. We continued to stake, to weed, and to find ways of keeping the crows, away from the watermelons. Crows didn't know or care that we were living in a pandemic, and they would feast in our garden when we were away. Though my family had not sold produce at the farmers' markets in years, our garden was surrounded by other Hmong growers who did. They were there before we arrived, and they were always the last to leave. Throughout the season, we watched as they tended to the land and hauled buckets of green beans and potatoes into the shade. When our watermelons ripened, my mother cut them open and handed out large slices to growers nearby who were gathering flowers for the next day's market. In return, I was gifted a summer bouquet and reminded that we exist for each other. I ran into some of the same growers when visiting various markets, and though they had seen fewer people come to shop, they were grateful that people came. For as long as people still came, they grew their produce and fed the valley. The crowd was certainly smaller than in previous summers, but the farmers' markets continued to offer an array of colorful produce, sweet berries, warm kolaches, and my new favorite, birch log birdhouses. At the end of the harvest, my family gathered and dried seeds, a practice that has preserved our history and culture over the years, and my mother filled each of our freezers with the summer's bounty. We gathered and boiled the Hmong corn, and we gave thanks to our ancestors for another good harvest. The Hmong New Year was not celebrated as a community after the harvest season. We did not gather for a ball toss or cultural performances. There was no need to worry about getting pepper sauce on traditional outfits or sticky fingers from spilled nava. However, all across the world, Hmong people celebrated in their homes, perhaps boiling corn too, and filling chest freezers full of green beans, eggplants, and squash shoots. Though we did not anticipate a pandemic and the ways it would change our lives, I do know that my mother and I will return to the garden every spring. We will call the crops and ask them to grow, and we know they will hear us. They will answer.
That was Eau Claire writer Yia Lor on Calling the Crops with her mother. This story also appeared in Volume 1 magazine. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talked to two journalists about their recent investigation into websites that profit off of spreading lies and falsehoods. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Back in high school, the bathroom wall is where you might see name-calling and the latest rumors about your peers. Fast forward to 2021, and there's a shady corner of the internet for that. Our next guest recently took a close look at what are called gripe sites, websites that let people post unverified accusations against others, and their connection to seemingly separate companies that let you pay money to get those gripes taken back off. Kashmir Hill is a technology reporter for the New York Times. Kashmir, welcome back.
Thank you, Rob.
And Aaron Kralik is an interactive news journalist and developer at the New York Times. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Kashmir, start us off. What are these gripe sites?
Well, these are sites on the internet that are kind of devoted to destroying people's reputations. They call for complaints. They have names like Deadbeats Exposed and Sex Predators, Worst Homewrecker. And they're basically a place where if you feel you've been mistreated by somebody else, you can complain about them. You know, what you write is not fact-checked. It's not verified. And so these sites do tend to attract a lot of lies about people, but lies that are very damaging because they start appearing high in Google search results for your name.
Right. And this, if it stayed obscure, maybe no big deal, Kashmir, but you trace the story of a guy who found himself, I mean, all over the internet. If anybody ever searched him for a job or a loan or anything, horrible things popped up. Can you share a little of his story?
Yeah, there was basically a group of people, but the people I really profiled in the piece were a family in Canada, and they just had their reputations absolutely destroyed. Somebody was writing about them on these sites, calling them scammers, you know, thieves, pedophiles, which is one of the worst accusations. None of it was true. And they Googled themselves, and it was all over their results. They went on this journey to figure out who it was. And it was a woman that their family had employed 30 years earlier, and she was still holding a grudge. It was very horrible for them, had real consequences for them in terms of their job prospects, just what people thought about them when they Googled them. And so it sent me and Aaron on this journey to understand who's behind these complaint sites. You know, what is the business model here? Who's making money off of this?
And Aaron, you took this for a spin by slandering yourself. Can you share that story?
Absolutely. So we, you know, Kashmir's initial investigation left a lot of questions, like, are these posts all original? Are they copying posts from site to site? So we really needed to run sort of an experiment of our own. And we ended up coming up with, I would post about myself on these sites. And we set up code that would track as the post spread from site to site, so we could map out the network.
And so what did you post, and how did you see it spread when you went to your first couple few gripe sites?
So we wrote "Aaron is a loser" and posted it on a couple of sites. And within 2 hours, the post had already been duplicated and spread. And within a couple of weeks, it was on the first page of my Google results. And it was pretty shocking.
Okay. And Kashmir, as you found both with Aaron and then the people you reported on, if I find out, okay, this false information is out there on these gripe sites, and I go to try to get it off, what happens next?
Yeah, so we found with Aaron, you know, he wrote 5 posts about himself, calling himself an unqualified loser. Within a few weeks, it was dozens of posts. And so the next step is, well, how do you get rid of these? And so what we discovered is that there was this kind of second parasitic industry, people calling themselves reputation managers, who said, hey, we can clean up your reputation for you. You just pay us, you know, a few hundred or a few thousand dollars. One of them quoted Aaron, I think, $2,000 to get one of the posts removed. And they said, yeah, you know, we're able to get these things deleted, and then we can remove it from your Google search results. So we started also investigating that industry. And what we found was that in some cases, the people that were purporting to be reputation managers and the people running the complaint sites were the same people. And so really what you had was just this extortion industry where these sites are calling for complaints and then charging the people complained about to have the post removed.
So Aaron, I want to hammer this home. The site where somebody might post this unfounded accusation is owned by the same people who are these reputation managers who get these things off of there. That's what you guys found out?
Yeah, they go through great lengths to obscure that information. But through some online analysis, we were able to link both the reputation management firms and some of the sites that host the content, host the slander.
Talking to Kashmir Hill and Aaron Krawlik from the New York Times, looking at these gripe sites where people can post unfounded accusations against other people. Those accusations spread, take over search results, maybe block you from getting that job interview you were looking for if people happen to search for you online. And now, Kashmir, apart from going to one of these reputation services and paying big money, the people you talked to, did they find any recourse to try to get this slanderous material taken off of these sites?
So there is a tool that you can use to get things not removed from the sites, but removed from your Google search results. And Google has actually had this tool in place for a couple of years, but even experts I talked about didn't really know about it because Google never kind of publicly announced, hey, we'll remove things from your search results for you. But in their help center, there are some forms and you can go there and submit a request saying, hey, this site has an exploitative removal policy. and you have to upload screenshots of, you know, the sites in your search results and proof that they're trying to charge you to get something taken down. But if you do all that, Google will sometimes, in some cases, remove this from your search results. And Aaron actually did that and was able to get one of the posts removed. But we did discover it's a little bit more complicated than that.
And Aaron, I just searched your name as we've been talking here. Just your name, I'm not seeing loser pop up too early. But if I search your name and loser, my top result is still Aaron Krawlik is an absolute loser. Will do whatever for attention, anything. Why did the changes you make, did the challenges you make manage to get at least the just your name from showing up as a loser?
Yeah, exactly. So when it's sort of unclear exactly how the Google removal tool works. But when you submit, you give it an example query. And in my case, it was just a search of my name. So we were able to clean it up when people search my name. Aaron Krawlik is a loser does not show up anymore.
But if I go in with the assumption that you're a loser, you're still coming up. I will warn you. Now, you two work for a newspaper, and so your name pops up a lot online. So maybe these sites aren't going to put you at the top of the list. Kashmir, for people who aren't so online present, how dominant can these sites be?
Yeah, I mean, that is the real problem. And it's what Google calls a data void. There are some people who they just don't have much about themselves on the internet. And that is who these gripe sites, these complaint sites are really preying upon. Because if you don't have much about you, these sites can just start ranking high really quickly. And so it's a huge problem. You know, after we did these two stories, both about victims of this and then about the sites and the people perpetuating it, we just got so many emails from people who have been subject to this, who have an online attacker who has just been coming after them relentlessly, who have their name on all of these sites, and they don't know what to do about it. They're, you know, in real duress. And so that's very sad to see. And I do hope that more people use this Google form, because as you found, it's not, you know, 100% effective, but it does help.
And Aaron, are you worried that this experiment, I mean, is going to leave this, no matter what you do, these searches on your web profile, maybe forever?
Yeah, it certainly could be forever. And that was something we weighed when we started out. But it was definitely worth it to help understand the ecosystem.
And now, Kashmir, a follow-up from your original reporting, the person who, that family you focused on, the person, the very disgruntled person who had been posting stuff about them on these gripe sites, ultimately arrested. Can you share some of that follow-up after your first story came out?
Yeah, so the people that she'd gone after, so she had written thousands of posts about over 100 people, and many of them had kind of band together and sued her in a Canadian court for defamation, and a court found in favor of her victims, but the judge ruled that his solution was that they now own the complaint site, the complaint post about themselves, and they have ownership of it and can go and try to get it removed, which is not super helpful. But the judge also said, you need to stop writing about these people. And she continues to do it. So she was arrested for basically violating the court order, put in prison, but then she was let out again, because this is a difficult issue. She is been harassing these people for a decade. She writes thousands of posts about them. She doesn't seem to be able to be stopped. She's homeless. She has no assets. But it's a real question. Should somebody be locked up for writing terrible things about people online? And judges are pretty hesitant to do that. So even though this has real consequences for people, you know, causes harm in their lives, it is hard for judges to lock people up. And so right now we're in this difficult position. Like, how do you stop people from doing this? And as a society, I don't think we have a solution yet.
And briefly, Kashmir, as we wrap up, are there calls for companies like Google to make it at least so these kind of sites don't show up at the top of a search?
There definitely are. A lot of people say, hey, Google, search engines, you need to fix this. And there are other people that are saying, hey, where is law enforcement? I mean, this is This looks a lot like extortion. You know, why are police not getting these complaint sites taken down? And again, it's, you know, just in terms of priorities, mean things on the internet just aren't at the top of the list. But you know, that may change as more and more of us have to live with this.
We'll leave it there. Kashmir, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Aaron, thanks for sharing your experiment.
Thank you.
That was Kashmir Hill and Aaron Krawlik with the New York Times. They joined us to talk about their recent piece, The Slander Industry. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate's guest is you. Call in with your suggestions for future conversations, recommend guests and topics. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news. Then we'll talk about the fight over a bipartisan commission to investigate the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. That and more in our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time.